The Extra Pack of Peanuts Travel Podcast, Episode 5. Switzerland has the highest rate of car theft per capita. I'll show you Paris in the morning. I'll show you London afternoon. If you feel your Dublin heart is burning, yeah, well, you don't have to worry, cause we're blowing it. Hello, travel nerds, and welcome to the Extra Pack of Peanuts Travel Podcast, the show that will inspire you to travel and then show you how to do it on any budget. I'm Trav, the creator of Extra Pack of Peanuts, and with me today is a man after my own heart, a fellow travel podcaster and travel enthusiast, Chris Christensen from Amateur Traveler. Chris, thanks for joining the show and welcome.
Well, thanks for inviting me. I love to talk about travel, not difficult.
Yeah, same here. This should be a nice episode then. So, Chris, obviously you enjoy traveling. You actually have two, and you actually, right before this, told me you have a third excellent travel podcast that I want to talk about a little later. But I'm interested in hearing a little bit of your backstory. What really began your love for travel? Were there a few specific instances you can point to that kind of made you become a travel junkie?
I came by my love for travel naturally. I gained a love of travel traveling with my parents, but we did hardly any international travel. Our international travel was only Canada. So for us, it was a road trip. It would be put the two kids in the car and pull a 14-foot trailer, which counted the hitch. So it's, not a very big travel trailer behind the car, and see how many miles we could put on it. And basically the success of a vacation was measured with the odometer. So I think our biggest vacation was about 5,000 driving miles. So,
wow. And was that a yearly thing or every summer? How did that work?
Every summer, we typically did some big trip. My father got up to, 3 weeks vacation. So we'd spend 2 or 3 weeks vacation. And it probably wasn't yearly. We went back and saw family sometimes instead. But I think we did a number of trips that really made an impression on me. So for instance, and I'm of a certain age, so I remember, for instance, when men landed on the moon for the first time, and I actually saw that. I watched that from a trailer park in Vancouver, British Columbia, and it was just very interesting seeing people talking about your country while you were somewhere else, and I think that was one of those sort of formative moments. But I didn't get outside of North America until after college.
Okay, yeah, very interesting. I was in the same boat a little bit. I did a lot of travel around the United States when I was younger, mostly down to Florida to see my grandparents and all. But yeah, it wasn't until I was 21 that I actually did international travel. And I consider that, outside of Canada and the United States.
Technically, I am told that Canada is another country. So.
Yeah, believe it or not, right? What are some specific things that stuck out to you as a kid? Were places you went or just kind of the feelings you had while you were traveling?
Well, in terms of places that I went, I think the big three would be Yellowstone National Park, probably Bryce Canyon, which is still one of my favorite national parks. We did a lot of travel to the national parks, and then the Canadian Rockies up in Lake Louise and Banff area are probably the trips that I remember the most from when I was a kid.
Oh, I'll actually be going up to Banff for the first time in July, so I'm looking forward to that. I'll have to hit you up for some tips, but I hear it's all beautiful. You can't really go wrong.
It's very beautiful, although the last time I went, I happened to time it when there were forest fires in the area, so unfortunately my family has only seen it with a haze descended in the valley, but it is a very beautiful area.
Oh, well, I guess there is one time you can go when it's wrong, and I guess you hit that.
Right.
So, Chris, all right, you obviously enjoy talking about traveling and enjoy traveling, and you have your podcast. Can you give the listeners just a little bit of information about your podcast, how they're structured, what things they'd expect to hear, when they tune into them?
Sure. I do, as you said, three shows. It's really two because there's a video show that I haven't put out an episode for a while, so we won't talk about that. But I do a weekly show called Amateur Traveler, and that show is predominantly an interview show. So I'm usually talking to someone who lives in a destination, grew up there, wrote the guidebook on it, just got back from there, something along those lines. We've covered everything from when you go to Chicago, what should you put on your Chicago dog, to going to Tonga and swimming with whales. And then the second show is This Week in Travel, which is probably more of an every other week show. We have a little more trouble getting that one out because that one I have two co-hosts, and one of them is Gary Arndt from everything-everywhere.com, and he is traveling, doing everything and traveling everywhere, so it's hard to schedule with him. And then also Jen Leo from the LA Times, and we have a little more trouble scheduling that one. But then that is usually a four-person conversation about travel news, and then also we'll be talking to a guest about their travels, the book that they just wrote, the travel blogging and writing industry, something along those lines. And so that's a fun one for us to do. A lot less preparation than Amateur Traveler. Amateur Traveler, each show is about 8 hours of preparation and production time, including audio editing and also putting in pictures for everything we talk about. So that's a pretty big labor of love there.
Yeah, and I've noticed the labor that you do put into it because it's really well produced, and you get some really neat.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's been an inspiration to me. You know, I started a travel podcast somewhat based on the fact that you were doing one. I liked what you did, and I thought I could leapfrog onto that and put my own spin on things.
Yeah, been doing that for a little while now. So
yeah, it's how many episodes now?
About 371 episodes or something, somewhere in that number, and I started in 2005. So it's been a few years now.
Kind of the birth of podcasting in 2005 when it was just coming along.
Yeah, the funny thing is I thought I was late to podcasting at the time. I actually was in podcasting before iTunes supported it, for instance, just slightly before that. So in the first year of podcasting, but it's funny that at the time it did seem like, well, everybody's podcasting, and of course, podcasting is undergoing kind of a renaissance here in the last year, especially as mobile has really become so dominant.
Right.
You know, that now more than 50% of people's internet activity is happening mobile. Well, podcast is just made for that because there are apps now that you can download the podcast directly to your iPhone, your Android phone, or whatever. And so that's really helpful. And then as actually also four car manufacturers are building Stitcher Smart Radio to into their dashboard, so you can get your podcast from your car dashboard. So we're excited about that, those of us who spend a lot of time in behind the microphone like this.
Yeah, and basically, I mean, any podcast you listen to that's produced with any consistency and any amount of quality, it is really a labor of love because it takes a lot more time than just sitting down, calling you on Skype and talking. There's a lot more to it that people behind the that aren't behind the scenes don't know. So we all appreciate the time you've put in and kind of been a trailblazer in the travel podcast niche there.
Well, thanks.
As far as Amateur Traveler, you focus mostly on, like you said, destinations and kind of getting the insider expert opinion on that. How do you find the experts from those places?
Well, that used to be harder when you've done so many episodes and you have built up an audience. And we'll get, basically, we've averaged about 1 million downloads a year over the last 3 years. And so that means that people are listening. And so people most of the time are suggesting people to me, oh, you really should talk to so-and-so. And then occasionally I'll say, well, you know, I really want to do a show on Stockholm, for instance, was one that came up lately. In fact, I think that's next week's show. And so I went out there and just hit my Twitter audience and said, who should I talk to about Stockholm? Or we'll have people who will, well, we've had people who plan their vacations around what will get them back on the Amateur Traveler,
which is
always funny when you get to that point. And, you know, we'll look at the map because we have a map that basically shows, I was going to say every episode, but the real truth there is that not every episode is on the map just because I don't have time to update it and check to see that all of them are there. But amateurtraveler.com/map is what I'm talking about, amateurtraveler.com/map.
Oh, neat. Okay,
and
cool.
We have things about quite a few places at this point, but we'll have someone, for instance, who I'm going to talk to tomorrow night, who's been on the show, I think, 5 times, who said, you know, I noticed you didn't have anything on Amsterdam. You know, what if I go to Amsterdam, which I'm thinking about doing, can I come back on the show? Can we talk about it? Yeah, sure. I'd love to talk to you again. So it's really helpful when you have people who have enjoyed doing it and also who've done such a good job that my audience has enjoyed them, who come back from time to time. And it's not uncommon at this point. I'd say probably about half of my guests are repeat guests at this point.
Yeah, that is really awesome. Something I didn't know. You know, you've just obviously built a community there that is engaged in your podcast and wanting to give back by coming on and sharing their knowledge. And I think that's kind of what it's all about when you have a website or a podcast or any medium like that, is engaging the audience so that you're getting as much from them as they're getting from you.
Well, and some of those are actual travel bloggers and podcasters themselves, or are now travel bloggers and podcasters. Some of them weren't when they started coming on the Amateur Traveler. I think of Sherry Ott, for instance, who has a popular travel blog, who basically says she got started because some guy who ran this travel podcast suggested maybe she should think about travel blogging. So, and then I know Nomadic Matt says that being on the Amateur Traveler was his first big break, and he's gone on to bigger and better things than that. So.
Yeah, that is really neat, and it's really nice to see. You know, 2005, that's a lot of episodes and a lot of people you've talked to, so it's cool to kind of have your tentacles in the travel blogging world without just your blog and your podcast. That's really cool.
Right. Well, and I love to have other storytellers on, and really what we're looking for is people who can tell a good yarn. And, you know, not everyone can. This is one of the things you learn when you start doing something like this, is they're the shows you will never hear. Basically, either because there wasn't enough content there, or some people just literally can't tell a story, can't put two sentences together and have it make any sense. So,
right. Yeah. Buried in the archives there, or buried even deeper than the archives, I guess, with some of those shows.
Exactly.
So overall, what has been the reception and feedback you've gotten from listeners about the podcast? You kind of talked about how it's grown. Mm-hmm. Is there certain things that they've told you in specific, like, I really, really like this about your show, or anything that you've heard over the years?
Sure. Well, a variety of things, and never, not necessarily consistent. I've heard I talk too fast.
Okay.
That is the kind of the negative sides. I've heard in some of the original shows, I heard there were problems with the audio, which there were. And so we've, worked to correct those over the years, but that was kind of the negative feedback side. On the positive feedback side, I tend to get, you're very easygoing and I like that. You don't try and dominate things. I've had people who were consultants for radio say, for instance, that I'm doing it wrong. And the reason that I'm doing it wrong is you really should make sure that your personality was much more upfront. You should never let the guest talk as long as you let them do, because it's all about you and people should come back for you. And I don't like that.
Yeah. So,
and I don't have to do that because it's my show. And so that tends to be the people who gravitate towards it, like that kind of easygoing, I feel like I can trust the information that I'm getting. And then we'll definitely have people say, well, gee, you talked about my hometown and I didn't like what they recommended. And I think that would be true with anything that the story of, is you're going to have a different opinion of things. And sometimes it's, wow, you did a great job of that, but you also should have mentioned these things. And sometimes, we had somebody come on who I thought did a terrific job on a show on Los Angeles, but he said, don't go to Disneyland. And frankly, I like Disneyland. So I disagreed with him on the show, but a lot of the people were just really didn't like his opinion, his Disneyland, Los Angeles, rather.
I'm sure that fired up, a lot of commenters or a lot of listeners.
Sure. But I actually would much rather have somebody who has the specific recommendations. I think you should do this. And the shows that are the most boring to me are the ones that I couldn't tell you. In fact, these are the ones that often don't get on these days. We've been talking for 10 minutes and everything you said could be said about 12 other places. You haven't given me any sense of why this place is different.
Right.
And, people say, well, I would just wander around. Well, that's true. So would I. But since you can say that about any place, tell me what neighborhood I should wander around in. Tell me what the vibe is going to be like when I see the sidewalk cafe. What should I stop and order? That's the sort of thing that I think starts to set one destination apart from the other. And sometimes you're going to like the show and you're going to, at the end of the show, going to, boy, I'm never going to go there.
Right.
And then other times, and this is the times that are exciting, is when people say, I've just bought my ticket, or I've just got back from, or Sherry, who I mentioned, for instance, went to Mongolia because we talked about it on Amateur Traveler. Now it's been back again, actually did the Mongol race to Mongolia, but had never thought about going there until she heard us talking about the wild horses of Mongolia and saw some of the pictures and things. And so that's when it gets really exciting now, is when people say, I save your shows. I listen to them and then I save the ones I like, and I've got a list of about 10 shows that's my to-do list. It's like, that's, okay.
Yeah, that's awesome. And that's, of course, that's the whole point of the show. And I agree with you. I really like when people get specific. And I found a really good way to do that when you're going somewhere new or traveling is to ask on Twitter. And it's not something that I used to do. I wasn't even on Twitter before, you know, maybe 8 months ago. But now I've got a pretty loyal following. I'll just say, hey, I'm going to San Francisco. I've never been here. Where should I eat? And people give me great recommendations, like go to Ike's place and get this sandwich. And that's the stuff that really makes me happy because, sure, you can wander around, you can do that. But I want to know where I can eat, where I should go to drink, where I should do this, where I should do that, and give specifics. Because usually if someone's willing to vouch for it and make it specific, it's probably pretty good. I haven't found that many places people have told me have been awful or not worth it.
Right. Well, and actually one of the reasons we've had sometimes people on from the tourist boards, and they actually tend not to make as good a guess because they want to tell you that it's a place for everybody,
right,
that everybody would like going there. Well, that's not true.
Right, right.
I understand why you're telling me that, but it's really not true that this is a place that's better for some people than others, and let's just help them figure out which are theirs. And then also, they don't want to say anything bad about everybody because that's where their money's coming from. And so we tend to ask the question of, you know, what do the guidebooks recommend that you think is a waste of time? And that has been a very useful question for me because – and sometimes I'll disagree with the answer. I have been to the place, and for me, that was a good destination. But I'm always interested in the answer. And the other thing is, if you've been to the destination, you can calibrate that person based on that answer to that question, too, as well. I enjoyed that museum, or I enjoyed that, or no, you're right. That really was a schlocky tourist trap. So,
and I think that's the value, too, in listening to the same podcast or reading the same blogs or websites kind of consistently is you start to know the host or the writer's opinions and how right. they relate to your own. You say, well, this guy doesn't like big box hotels, and neither do I. So I'm going to go read his stuff when he talks about staying at a local guest house because I know he has the same type of opinions.
Right, exactly. One of the things that's surprising to me, I tend to be a nerd. You said travel nerds. I completely relate to that.
I'm raising my hand.
Yeah, in my day job, I'm a tech geek. I've been everything from a programmer to an EVP of engineering and operations. So I am a geek by training and by vocation. And my travel is related to basically one of the reasons that I love travel, getting back to your original question, is I love to learn. And okay. So for me, travel forces you to learn, especially international travel, because you're in a situation that the rules aren't quite the same, the language is different, and all of those things I really just thoroughly enjoy. I thoroughly enjoy being in a train station in Prague and have to figure out in Czech how to operate a ticket machine. You know, you're completely lost.
Sure. I think the point you're making, and I think I've heard this a lot, is kind of the uncomfortableness of travel. Maybe, you know, a little bit of you have to figure stuff out, and you're kind of always have heightened senses because you can't just put yourself on cruise control and drive down the road and 10 minutes later get to your destination and have never seen anything. You have to constantly think, where am I going? What am I doing? And I think that helps you take in all the little nuances that you forget about when you're at home.
Well, and for me, I'm very interested in the history of the place too, the history and the culture and the language. And I love the fact that in Chinese, the symbol for good is a woman under a roof. I mean, it tells you, you may not agree with it, but it tells you something about the culture. It's an important cultural term there. And two women under the same roof is the symbol for strife, is my understanding. So, you know, that sort of trivia I enjoy, the history of a certain place. And so when I have guests on, if they don't provide the history, I'm often jumping in and doing that. Well, it was interesting. We just did a interview or a survey recently and found out that the audience that listens to Amateur Traveler is an educated audience. And I sort of suspected that would be the case because I would bore the pants off of somebody who really doesn't want to know that kind of detail. But I was a little surprised how educated, because 82% have 4-year college degrees, and that wasn't too surprising. And the others are mostly just too young to have their 4-year college degree. And then the thing that was a little more surprising is, of that 82%, almost 30% have a master's and almost 10% have a doctorate.
Wow.
So it tends to be a very educated audience, and you know, and obviously at that point, they also have the money to travel. I mean, that's one of the things about people who are thinking about international travel is that it can be expensive, especially if you don't have as much time. Right. If you have time to do it more slowly, it can be cheaper per day than if you're doing what some of us do, which is, you know, jet setting across the world for a week and then flying back again.
Right. And running around during that week trying to see.
Crazy. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, 16 museums. And
that's right.
Eat 14 dinners in a week because you have all the places you want to eat and stuff like that.
Well, that's if I'm by myself. When I'm with my family, I am at half speed because I have learned that their pace is not the same as my pace. But
right. And that's one of the things that I think is important about your show. I mean, I've had a few guests on recently who have these, you know, crazy, unique, amazing travel experiences, which is awesome. But your show focuses on the typical American, and this is from your site, the typical right. American who travels 2 weeks out of the year. And I think, obviously, we all wish we could travel, or anyone listening to this show probably wishes they could travel more than they already do. But it's just not feasible for some people. So what are some of the best tips that you can give someone who has a limited amount of time but wants to maximize their experiences when they actually do travel?
Well, you know, certainly one is listen to a travel podcast and prepare yourself ahead of time. But I think that's part of the, in my view, the preparation is part of the fun. Part of the reason I enjoy travel is that I spend some time ahead of time, or at least I used to before I was busy doing travel blogging and podcasting. And now I do much less preparation than I used to. So, you know, part of it is, you know, if you have time, learn the language ahead of time. We had a friend who said, I'm going to turn 40 and I'm going to do it at a villa in Tuscany. I got a bonus and I'm going to rent a villa in Tuscany for a week. I'd love to have you come with me. I mean, I'm not going to pay your way, but for the nights that you want to stay at the villa, that I'll be taking care of that. And he told us in September, and he was planning the party for May. And so I actually learned enough Italian to be able to ask directions and get around. And it makes a huge difference as you have learned anything about the culture. It multiplies how much you understand when you're there. And so that's something that I really enjoyed doing in the past. Before, again, I was doing a lot of podcasting and blogging. I was more of a collector of languages, had studied quite a few different languages, all usually in preparation, either preparation for travel or, for instance, I'd studied Mandarin because I live in a neighborhood here in San Jose that's 80% Mandarin or 80% Mandarin speaking. So.
Yeah, I think there's something we said for learning language. Even like you said, most of us aren't going to become fluent within 4 or 5 months. But
I'm only fluent in English when properly caffeinated. So
Yeah, right. The basics are usually enough not only to kind of find your way around, but I think it puts you on another level then from the tourists who come and don't know anything, because the locals will, you know, they obviously know that you've put some time in, and I think that it can really open up a lot of doors for you,
absolutely,
not just
absolutely.
Because of what you say, but because how they look at you then.
And I've told this story on Amateur Traveler, but it reminds me when we went to Milan in Italy, we happened to go to the same restaurant two nights in a row. And that's unusual for us. We're usually traveling more than that. We want to try something place else. But we were eating out by our hotel, which is out in a neighborhood further away from the city center. And when we went to find a place to eat the second night, we couldn't find anything that was open. That was a private party and such. We had a great dinner last night. Let's just go back to that one. So we go back to that one. Well, the night before, I had been speaking Italian because I'd been studying Italian, even though the waiters were the sons of the owners and they spoke fine English. It really right. didn't need the Italian. But, you know, hey, darn it, I study the language. I'm going to use it. So I ordered an Italian, whatever. The second night, though, we come in, and it was really funny because Mama, the owner of the restaurant, speaks no English at all, greeted me, and she recognized me as the one who was speaking Italian. And then she said, you're the one who was speaking Italian. All in Italian, of course. And we were family. It was really a very, very different experience. Every time we looked over, she was looking at us. She was beaming. You know, normally you'd be given your pizza and your pizza cutter, and you'd have to cut your pizza yourself. And she started to do that. And then, no, she cut it for it. But, you know, it's just a different level of service.
Yeah.
You're different because you bothered to learn just a few phrases of Italian. I mean, all I remember at this point is, io parlo italiano non molto bene. I don't speak Italian very well. But
well, if you're going to remember one, you might as well remember that.
Exactly. That's the phrase I remember in about 8 languages. But
I think, too, and I'm guilty of this as well, I think most of the time when people do learn a language, they feel like they have to be perfect at it before they try it.
And that you have to get over that.
Yeah. Right?
In fact, I don't know the past tense or the future tense that I think in any language except English. And again, only when properly caffeinated. But, you know, you find other ways of saying it that get the message across.
Yeah, and everyone will know right away you're obviously not fluent in it just by you talking, but you know, they're going to understand you even if you're like you said the tense is wrong. And like I said, I'm guilty of that as well. I lived in Japan for 2 years and I always felt uncomfortable speaking language because obviously everyone I talked to was fluent, but once I kind of made myself get out of that, it really was liberating. And it's obviously neat because you know, a lot of times when we're older, we don't really get to learn something completely new. And language is something you can say, you know, I started at the bottom, I knew nothing, and now I can do this. So that's a really, really good tip. Is there anything else as far as kind of maximizing the time that you have on the ground in your destination that you would suggest people do?
Well, one little trick. Well, I'm a travel photographer. I love photography, and so I'm a very visually oriented person when I'm traveling. And one thing I like to do is just check out the postcard stand. Basically, when you get to a destination, see what other people have seen there, because occasionally you'll go, well, what is that?
Yeah.
I've never heard of this place. And you'll discover something that you've never heard of. And these days, you can go on Flickr and see, you know, the photographs ahead of time that might pertain to a particular destination. Obviously, you look in your guidebook and such. But the postcard stand is also a great way to just see what the locals are most proud of.
Yeah, that's a very, very neat recommendation. Not one that I've ever actually encountered before. But I definitely have been standing places where I've looked at postcards and thought, Why did I not go to there? You know, what is that? And then you flip it around to the back, and sometimes it's in a language you can't understand. You're like, wait a second. But yeah, very good recommendation. One of the questions that I'm sure you get a lot, and you know, I get when I'm talking to people who don't travel as much, and it sometimes takes on different forms, but it usually boils down to this idea of, you know, why is travel important, or why should I travel? And so when you hear that kind of question, What are the answers that you have to people about why they should travel?
Well, I don't usually try and talk people into travel because that's just more crowds I have to contend with. But I think there are two different answers to that question. One is, for me, I think travel broadens your perspective. And I found that even as a kid, the fact that I had been to other states made it that I had a broader perspective than a lot of the people that I knew who grew up in California and had barely been out of that state. I mean, it's a big state, but
yeah, there's a lot to do, but still.
And then I think international travel even more so, but even travel around the US, I think, broadens your perspective. And I think that's valuable. And it also teaches you that there are different ways of doing things. Sometimes they're just different. Some, you know, you may find this one to be right or wrong, or right or wrong for you, but sometimes they're just different. And then I think as a society, I think that's the other advantage is, I think, for instance, when you have been to Istanbul and you've, you know, had a wonderful experience with the Turkish people, then when somebody is telling you, oh, those Muslims, they're just this way, you go, well, you know, that is not my experience.
Right.
And I think that if more people traveled and crossed borders, I think we would have more understanding. And I think travel is very useful for that. And I've caught in some flack, for instance, for recommending to go to this country or that country at a given time when there may be some political reason not to. And because I tend to err on the side of, I think travel is better for us. I think if we are traveling and exchanging ideas and meeting each other, that will help solve some of the issues that we have internationally as well. So I fall way on that side in terms of travel being good, and good often for the locals too, in terms of economy, especially in third world countries, as long as it's done responsibly, of course.
Right. Yeah. And I completely agree. I think this sounds silly, but I think one of the things that really makes me realize how important travel has been in my life is if I'm watching a movie or a TV show and all of a sudden they show somewhere that I've been, instantly all those memories come flooding back to me. And
it's
such a richer, you know, viewing experience that, I mean, that just shows you how important travel is, because I'm sitting there thinking, hey, I know what they're doing. Like when, you know, in Tomb Raider, when Lara Croft is in the Angkor Wat and all, I think that, you know, I know what's happening there. That's not true. There's not a floating village outside of Angkor Wat, you know? So I just think it's a pretty cool, you can't really quantify it, but I think that is one way that I, in my life, it is quantified. I just think I was there. Someone talks about it, like talks about the Japanese work ethic. And I think, well, yeah, no kidding. I worked with Japanese people. They work way harder than I ever want to work. Right. So
it's richer for you, perhaps. It's not always richer for the people who are trying to watch the movie with you while you're trying to say, oh, look, that's the Sultanahmet Mosque. And, you know, I've been there. And, you know, they don't always appreciate that, I've learned.
But yeah, I guess that's why I'm usually watching movies alone at this point.
could be it.
Another thing that I always get from people, and again, I'm not trying to tell everyone they have to travel. I think it's something that most people want to do inherently, but I always get the excuse that people say,
I think a lot of people don't. I think you'd be surprised how many people, well, if you look at the numbers and Expedia puts out a survey, for instance, how many people don't even stay in a hotel room one night in a year. Huh. Some of that is going to be economic.
Sure.
But some people, I've definitely worked with people, known people just as educated as I am, you know, make the same kind of money that I do, and they really like the familiar.
Yeah.
And they really like going back to the same place over again. And it's sometimes it's related to what else is going on in your life. If your life tends to be familiar from day to day, you may crave new.
Right.
And for those of us, you know, who are travelers, that's sometimes the case. And then for others, their life may be a little less controlled and then they crave familiar. So for some people, the perfect vacation, you know, is go to that beach that's 50 miles away and go there every year, rent the same house.
Right.
And I don't relate to that, but I know that that is true. And I know that's true for some people.
Yeah. And I guess the point I was trying to make too is even if they are doing that, which again, I don't relate to as well, I'd like to go new places and stuff like that is, you know, I guess they're at least getting out and doing some sort of travel. But what I usually hear from everyone is, you know, especially with me, they say, you know, well, we know you don't make a lot of money, but how can you travel so much? For you, what are some ways that you've learned that you can save money on travel, whether it's in how you get to the destination or what you do when you're actually there?
Well, you know, being a travel blogger and being offered free destinations is pretty nice. But before that, really, what we found is, well, hotels, for instance, I am not a 4-star hotel kind of guy. I don't want there to be bed bugs and I don't want to wake up with a sore back from a bad mattress. But really, as long as the place is clean, I sleep with my eyes shut.
Right.
And so I'm really just looking for a place that's quiet and comfortable, and it doesn't have to be the most expensive place. You know, apartments can be a wonderful place.
Yep.
In terms of saving money too. And we tend to not be so much in the hostel crowd because we started traveling, you know, a little later for one thing, but I've done hosteling. I prefer a private room when I'm in a hostel, but again, that can be a pretty, you know, cheap way to save money is, okay, I've got my own room, but I'm sharing a bath down the hall. Well, that's really no big deal.
Right.
I share a bath down the hall now. So
yeah, I'm at that point. Finally, at age 30, my wife has said, hey, we're done with the bunk bed dorm rooms. If we're doing a hostel, you know, you better be getting me a private room. And I think on the topic of hostels, too, a lot of hostels now aren't really what people think of hostels. Springs popping out of the mattresses, $5 night places.
Right. And also quite a few good for families, too.
Yeah, it's a lot more of this kind of luxury hostel or almost like a boutique hotel, guest house place. You know, sure, you can still find the dive hostels, but I think there's been a real big push to have these kind of luxury hostels that I try to stay in just because there is more character. You know, usually it's locally owned, which I love supporting,
right,
you know, the actual
right.
people on the ground there. And I think that you get a really authentic feel when, you know, you're living somewhere and the whole family's taking care of the hostel and they're cooking you dinner and you're with a traveler from Sweden and someone else from India and you're all there together, as opposed to these kind of antiseptic 4-star, 5-star hotels where you don't even see the person next to you. But
well, and then you also don't interact with locals as much when you stay in the resorts, especially. We don't tend to stay in the resorts for that reason, is they isolate you from the culture. And that's not why I travel. But the other thing, too, then is when you travel. If you have the flexibility to not travel in the high season, to not travel in summer, if you don't have kids in school, for instance, then you can save a lot of money. Just don't, you know, just stay home in July and August in particular.
Right.
And for those of us who have the option to do that, so I'm doing a trip here in June, and then I'm doing a trip in October, and I'll be home in the summer. And, you know, frankly, it's pretty nice here in the summertime, too. So that's really not a problem for me. And even going off season, we've done Europe in the December, for instance, and it can get cold. It's sure. I'd like to get back to Prague when it's not freezing, but that can save you money as well.
Yeah, I think that's a great recommendation. I know, you know, I do a lot of talking with frequent flyer miles and stuff like that, and they always give deals for off peak, and you can obviously sure, find right. better availability. That same goes for paid flights. You know, you can get stuff that's almost half off or even more than half off what you would pay in peak season. And I don't know how much haggling you do for rooms and stuff, but, you know, I found that if I go to a place, I'm going to be there for a little bit and I might, you know, book one night ahead of time somewhere, and I'll go and I'll kind of scope it out and see how busy it is. And if it's not busy, I'll just go to the front desk and say something like, hey, you know, I'm looking to stay here a couple more nights. What's the best deal you can give me? And if it's not busy and it's a small place, like a local place, usually you can get some pretty good deals.
You see, I'm way too shy for that. No, I could do that on the internet, but that would be trauma for me.
Well, it doesn't always work. I mean, and like I said, my wife sometimes is like, do you really care about saving that $5 or $10? And, you know, sometimes I might go a little overboard, but I do enjoy kind of the banter of it too, because if it's done good naturedly, especially in places like third world countries, I think, who welcome tourists and you know, depend on that kind of tourism-driven society, I think it's pretty fun because, you know, they're trying to get a good deal, you're trying to get a good deal, and in the long run, everyone's friends anyway, so.
Right. And then we do use, you know, frequent flyer credit cards and book up a lot of frequent flyers and then try and book the trip far enough in advance. For instance, right now we're looking at that October trip to Ireland.
Okay.
And we're looking at the miles now.
Right.
Because this is the time to be doing that sort of trip. If you're not doing miles, then 6 weeks out is, according to most studies, usually the ideal time to book in terms of getting the lowest fare. As you get closer, it'll go up. As it's further away, it'll go up. And so 6 weeks out, if you're paying for it, but much further ahead if you're planning on using miles.
Yeah, and I get that question all the time from people, you know, when should I look for availability? And I tell them if it's peak season, like if you want to go in July to Europe, you better start looking 330 days out because that's when they release the seats and those are going to go quick.
And if but you're going to pay more if you do that because they know you want to go.
Oh, I meant with frequent flyer miles.
Oh, frequent flyer, yeah. Absolutely. Sorry.
No problem. Yeah, and I think, but I do think, yeah, very good point. 6 weeks out, I've heard that too, is kind of an industry standard. If mm-hmm. you can afford to wait that long in terms of, right. you know, maybe you don't know whether you're going to get the best deal or not, but yeah, that's a good time frame. And yeah, with frequent flyer miles, I just tell people as early as possible, whenever you know, start looking because there's not going to be more availability opening up except for very specific instances if you're flying business or first class sometimes, stuff like that. So, Chris, at this point, I don't know if you know offhand, but how many different countries or destinations have you been to? Because you have 371 shows.
So Less than that. No, in terms of number of countries, I haven't totaled it recently, but I think it's sub 30.
Okay.
So there's still many places that I'd like to get to. I mean, I've been to, in terms of continents, I've been to Australia and Asia and Europe and obviously North America. I haven't been to South America and I haven't been to Antarctica.
Yeah, I also haven't been to South America.
I've seen South America in the distance from Curacao and Aruba, but I have not been there yet.
That's like me. I was at the Strait of Gibraltar, so I've seen Africa, but I haven't quite gotten
there. Oh, I've been
to
Africa too. Sorry. I know I was missing a continent there, but I couldn't find it. Yeah, I've been to and only twice. There's still a lot of Africa I haven't seen, a lot of Asia I haven't seen. I've been to Tanzania and I've been to Egypt as well in Africa. I'd love to get back. Both of those just amazing trips.
So, yeah, what are some of the places that you're, I guess I'll ask a twofold question. What are some of the places you're itching to return to that you have been? And then on top of that, what are some of the places that you haven't been that you really want to go to?
I tend not to be itching to return to places that I have been just because there are so many places that I haven't been to yet. Venice would be a different, you know, okay. Venice and Rome, Italy, I have just a real fondness for. But I would probably do that, for instance, on the way to Croatia or someplace that I haven't been. In terms of places that I want to get to, Israel, Jordan, South Africa, Southern Asia, Southeast Asia, I haven't been to yet. In South America, I think Argentina and Peru are certainly pushing way up my list.
Right.
Portions of Mexico. I have thoroughly enjoyed trips to Mexico. I'd love to get to San Miguel de Allende, for instance, in Mexico is one of the places that's place that I'd like to get to, or to Copper Canyon also is one of the places that I'd love to get to there. Those are kind of the places, and Ireland we'll be getting to this year. That's the plan. That's one of the places that's high on my list, but lots of places that I still need to see.
Have you read the book Born to Run?
I have not.
Okay. Well, I did a book recommendation list earlier this year, and it's definitely the number one book I recommend, and I hate running, so it's not...
Okay.
It's not like I love to run, trust me, but it is about the Tarahumara who live in the Copper Canyons in Mexico, and it's just a great story about how they, you know, are able to run 50, 100 miles at a time. They're these kind of super athletes, and how the outside world has then... only seen them in glimpses and how they've interacted with it. And it takes kind of their story as well as the story of running and stuff like that, again, which doesn't interest me really, but it paints it in a really cool, really neat way. And it's a great story. And that's kind of the first I had ever heard of the Copper Canyons and kind of the desolation that is there. So highly recommended.
It's actually less desolated, for instance, than... say the Grand Canyon. It's more verdant than that, a mixture of the copper colors as well as some real greens in the area as well.
Right. And unfortunately, I just read an article today about how the drug cartels are coming in there, planting their crops and doing it because it's so hard to get to and so hard to navigate that, you know, basically they have free rein if they go in and plant their stuff there, which is kind of sad.
Yeah, no, I think you're probably still safe on the train that goes through the Copper Canyon.
Yeah.
But I think walking through the Copper Canyon, there has been some problems up there in Chihuahua, which I just love to say really also is the other advantage of going to Chihuahua. But
yeah, well, going to Mexico in general, it's pretty cool to pronounce a lot of the towns and cities that you pass through. Always a plus when you're traveling. On the flip side then, what are some of the places that you don't necessarily either want to go to if they exist, or that you wouldn't really go back to anytime soon for whatever reason?
And I get that question a lot. I can't think of a place that I went to and I really didn't like in terms of a country, for instance, specifically. Rock Springs, Wyoming was not my favorite. It's a dreary little place. But other than that, in terms of places that I wouldn't go to, there's certainly some places I am not the... I am more adventuresome than my wife, for instance, and there are a number of places that I would go to that I don't think she's ready to yet, like India, for instance.
Okay.
But Congo, for instance, is not on my list right now. And some of those places where they're just a little too crazy right now, I really aren't on my list. I mean, Ethiopia I'd love to get to, but not probably Somalia.
Sure. Well, I just went to India in August, so... I would tell you that if your wife isn't as adventurous as you, yeah, it's very, very difficult traveling.
We're working our way up there. You know, 2 years ago, she had never been any place that she couldn't drink the water. And now she's been to Mexico. Finally, I've been there 18 times, I think. But she finally got her to Mexico. And then she's been to China now as well, and Hong Kong, and all of those were wonderful trips. So we're just kind of doing it in steps.
Yeah, there you go.
We'll do Southeast Asia before we do India. So
yeah, I'd recommend that. Having been to Southeast Asia a bunch, and then I thought we went to Southeast Asia a few times, and before we went to India, we were in Indonesia, and I thought, okay, well, we're going to India. I've been to Southeast Asia a ton. You know, I guess I just in my head didn't think anything would be different. And we landed in India, and for the first 3 or 4 days, I was in shock. It was so different from anything I had experienced. Both me and my wife were just, and we were in Mumbai, so it was crazy, and there's people everywhere.
Right.
And I had never felt that way really when I traveled before, except maybe like the first time I went to Southeast Asia was a little, I didn't know what to do, but India really threw me for a loop, and it was a great trip in the end, but after, I think we did 17 days there, after that, I just thought, man, I got to get out of here, because it was tough. And I heard a quote from a guy who said, I guess there's two types of travelers, the travelers who have been to India and the travelers who haven't, and I don't think either one is a bad thing, but I think he was onto something with that. I'd go back, but I think I might be a little more prepared this time. Chris, you have a ton of guests on the show, all of which are experts of that certain place. So you constantly hear about, you know, the best things to do here, the best things to do there, and you've touched on that a little bit. Mm-hmm. Is there some sort of suggestions or activities that always come up time and again?
Suggestions or activities? Well, besides just wandering around.
Besides wandering around or like look outside, or I mean, I guess you always get eating and places to eat and drink tips.
We certainly get that. I don't know if there's anything that we have a variety of people who come on the show, and so I don't know if there's anything that always comes up. There are certainly some things that have come up more than once. So for instance, one of the things that I think a lot of American travelers haven't thought about is couch surfing. And I don't necessarily mean sleeping on somebody's couch, which is what couch surfing traditionally means, but meeting up with a local through a hospitality organization like Servas or couch surfing is something that I know a number of people recommend, even people who are post-hostel, post-sleeping on couches, but still have talked about wonderful experiences meeting someone who's from there and seeing the place through the eyes of a local. And I think some of the places that I have enjoyed particularly, for instance, I think of Istanbul. I went to visit a Turkish exchange student who had lived with us for most of a year. And one of his friends was going to an English-speaking university in Istanbul. And so he was our tour guide. And he had been taking classes in the art and the history of Istanbul. And so he could look at the tiles and tell you, you know, well, this is an Isnik tile. And notice if you go over here that they're not nearly as pretty because basically as the plague came through, they lost a lot of the artistry that went into some of these things that I would have not seen, you know, sure. I just would have been completely ignorant of. And when you have somebody who knows those sort of things or knows where to go or where not to go or how to go in the back route, that can be very interesting and can certainly add to the richness of a place. And even if you just strike up a conversation, you know, with somebody who's local. I was sitting in the Zocalo in Oaxaca, Mexico, and struck up a conversation with someone who is a weaver. It was a Zapotec family. So his family had been in the area for at least 2,500 years. And he does weaving in the traditional way. And he said, you know, why don't you come with me? I'll meet you at your hostel tomorrow and I'll be your tour guide. We'll go out to some of the places where people go, to the well-known market, to the big tree that people go to. We'll also go out to one of the other sites out there, one of the other Zapotec sites. And then I'll take you to my studio and we'll show you the weaving. And I knew he wanted to sell me a rug.
Of course, but...
You know, that was not a problem. I didn't buy a rug, but I did actually capture some video of the weaving process, including the grinding up of the cochineal, which is a bug that grows on cactus that they use to make the traditional red dyes. Huh. And it was fascinating. And basically, I bought him a beer when we were in the market. And for the price of a beer, I had a tour guide for the day. And I was able to help him out, hopefully. I was able to put his name and face on video that went up on the web that a lot of people have seen. And hopefully he's gotten some business out of that. His contact list information there too. So I think it was good for both of us, but it's just one of those things where I met him while I was traveling. And because I was able to see things through him, I watched the people go by on the big bus tours and they were not having nearly as much fun as I was.
Not at all. I totally agree. I've done a little bit of the meetup stuff. You know, if you use couchsurfing.org, they have meetups always going on. You join a group and you can see when people are doing that. I've done some of it with a few different, you know, kind of like that manufactured meetup stuff. But yes, mm-hmm. And that's great because you always have people wanting to show you around the city, no matter where you go. I've never wanted to see the city like kind of with a tour guide, a local, and not been able to find a way to do that. And sometimes, like you said, it's this natural, organic thing where you just have to be open to. I had the same kind of thing in India where we were with a tuk-tuk driver and he said, hey, after you guys eat dinner, you know, why don't you come hang out with me? I'm going to show you my friend's rug place again, same thing. And, you know, he sells to all the big stores, Anthropology and all these well-known, you know, high-end clothing stores in America. And yeah, I know he wanted to sell us stuff. And of course, my wife was totally keen to go because she loves buying stuff. And we went and it was just really, really, really neat. And we ended up, you know, buying something small like a scarf. But it was really cool because he showed us how everything was done. And I think most of the time, if you're not open to that, you know, most people would probably say, ah, no, that's okay. You don't have to pick me up after dinner. But we thought, well, you know, what's the worst that's going to happen here? And then we got to see this whole other side that you wouldn't see if you're sitting at a restaurant or at the hotel pool, which I also love doing. But
right. Well, and of course, your tourist radar has to be out there, too, is what, because the worst that can happen is not so good.
Well, yes. Yeah.
And so you're really evaluating the situation and you're using, you know, your radar there to try and determine, is this a situation?
Sure.
Because in some ways you're thinking, my goodness, this seems like a foolish thing to do. And yet, you know, when you correctly judge the situation, that can be a really wonderful experience.
Yeah. But, and I wouldn't suggest, you know, it was me and my wife. So there is two people. I mean, I probably... Mm-hmm. I don't know if I would have done it on my own. I usually would not suggest that a female do it on their own or anything like that. But yeah, I think the more you travel, though, like you said, your tourist radar kind of gets stronger because you've been in situations that you would be scared of in the past or hesitant to. And then, you know, since it's everything has been okay up to that point, you kind of know what will and what won't be okay, which I think can only come from experience sometimes. Hopefully all good experiences.
Right, hopefully.
So, Chris, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. I mean, I follow your podcasts. I've loved them. They've kind of gotten me into this whole idea of travel podcasting, so I really appreciate it. Before I let you go, tell people where they can find you online, how they can follow you and your podcasts.
Sure. You can find me at amateurtraveler.com. You can also find Amateur Traveler and This Week in Travel both in any popular podcast directory, both the iTunes, the Zune podcast directory, the BlackBerry directory, all of those things, Stitcher Smart Radio, all of those places. It's not that hard to find. You can also follow me on Twitter at Chris2X.
Yeah, and I actually always love that Twitter handle with the Chris Christensen, the Chris2X. I thought that was really neat.
My father stutters. That's how I explain the name. So,
all right. Well, listeners, if you have a question for Chris that we haven't answered here in the podcast, you can leave a comment over on the post at extrapackofpants.com. I'll make sure Chris gets them, and if he has time, can elaborate on some of those things. If you are an expert on a specific destination and you think it'd make for a good podcast, I know Chris is always looking for people to be on the show. Head on over to amateurtraveler.com. I'll put a little plug in here for you, Chris. Make sure you read the post, How to Pitch a Show Idea.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, which is under the contact tab. He's put a decent amount of time into what he does want to hear, what he doesn't, and lays it all out very clearly. So read that before you just start sending things like, love your show, want to be on it. And, you know, then just send Chris an email. I think it'd be really neat if an Extra Pack of Peanuts reader or listener got to be on the show. So go for it if you're an expert. And also, Chris, they should look at what you've done previously, correct?
Right. But that it says that in that description as well. Yes, you just did a show on such and such, and I can do it better. Well, that's never going to happen. So maybe a year from now.
Once again, thanks so much for being on the show. I look forward to continuing to listen to your podcast.
Great. Well, thanks for having me on.
And listeners, if you like the podcast, don't forget you can subscribe to it on iTunes. If you're really feeling generous, go ahead, give it a rating. Us podcasters love to see those five little stars next to our name. So until next time, happy free travels. Yeah, well, you don't have to worry, 'cause we're going there soon. You don't have